Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. We are still in the Massachusetts debates. We're really just getting started. And I want you to know that as we go through these things, we're going to be discovering things like, you know, the no-brainers. I mean, things that people complain about, like how Congress passes a law and how it doesn't apply to them. Well, they can't do that contractually, because in Massachusetts, they clearly stated that in the terms of the contract that Congress cannot pass a law that does not equally oppress them. In other words, they can't immune themselves from, you know, the laws that they pass, like giving themselves their own health care. Now, first of all, you have to understand that there is no power in the Constitution that is enumerated their jurisdiction and their ability to mandate or even create a national health care plan or even regulate health care. There's no amendment to the Constitution granting them this power. And so, and I want to be clear, I don't think that we should ever consider amendments to give the federal government any power over domestic matters. It's one thing that they kind of arbitrate between the states regarding trade or the commerce, I should say, but it's a completely different bear and a completely different issue if we actually start letting them regulate and mandate and actually you have give them the power over education, housing, and the things that they have usurped from the states. So with that, we're going to be getting into the Massachusetts, like I just said, the Massachusetts debates. And so what we're not going to be doing is we're not going to be covering the marketing and all that stuff. So if you want to know what else is coming up and what's around the corner, go to reclaimingtherepublic.org. And as you go there, that's where our sponsor is. That's where you can get yourself your Red State coffee to support this show. And you can also get all the information you need regarding Republic Review. This way you'll understand what it takes to get the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution. So what we want to do is we want to get into the rest of these highlights. Now, when I say we're covering the Massachusetts debates, I'm not reading the full thing. I mean, it's 134 pages, 75,000 plus words. Not going to do that. But what we are doing is we're reading the highlights of the comments that are being made so that you understand how they were defining the Constitution. This is how they understood it. And based on this understanding, these are the legal definitions and clarifications, legal clarifications of the Constitution. And so with this next comment, this is coming from Mr. Symes. And this is what he says. I humbly submit it, sir, whether if each state had its proportion of some certain gross sum assigned according to its numbers, and a power was given to Congress to collect the same in case of default in the states, this would not have been a safer constitution. For, sir, I also disapprove of the power to collect, which is here vested in Congress. It is a power, sir, to burden us with a standing army of ravenous collectors. Now, see, Massachusetts is what right here, Mr. Symes in Massachusetts is talking about how a standing army isn't necessarily what we would understand as the military army. Now, in Britain and throughout ancient societies, ancient republics and so forth, there was no difference. The army and or the military was the form of, you know, fighting wars as well as basically shaking people down and taking tax money and so forth from them. And anyway, he says, a standing army of ravenous collectors, harpies, perhaps from one state, but who, however, will never have known to have bowels for any purpose but to fatten on the lifeblood of the people. So he's also pointing out that these armies, these are like mercenaries coming from other states. And he also says that in an age of two, this will be the case. And when the Congress shall become tyrannical, these vultures, these servants, will be the tyrants of the village by whose presence all freedom, speech, and action is taken away. So he's kind of predicting what's going to happen because the Congress has this ability to tax. What he hasn't gotten into and what they haven't covered, which is really extensively covered in Virginia, is how the militia is the only one that can execute these laws. The militia, your own militia, is the one that is supposed to be collecting. Just like in the Whiskey Rebellion, it was the militia as well as George Washington traveling out to the, you know, to the rebellious people and collecting the taxes and arresting those who were basically violating the federal law. Anyway, this next one is Mr. Dawes, and this is what he says. Observed upon the authority of Congress to raise and support armies, that all the objections which have been made by gentlemen against standing armies were inapplicable to the present question, which was that as there must be authority somewhere to, excuse me, somewhere to raise and support armies, whether the authority ought to be in Congress, as Congress are the legislature upon the proposed plan of government, in them only, said he, should be lodged the power under debate. Some gentlemen seem to have confused the idea about standing armies, that the legislature of country should not have the power to raise armies, is a doctrine he had never heard before. Charles II in England kept in pay an army of 5,000 men, and James II augmented them to 30,000. This occasioned a great and just alarm through the nation, and accordingly, when William III came to the throne, it was declared unconstitutional to keep or stand to keep a standing army in time of peace without the consent of the legislature. Most of our own state constitutions have borrowed from this language from the English Declaration of Rights, but none of them restrain their legislatures from raising and supporting armies. Those who never objected to an authority in Congress as vested by the old Confederation surely ought not to be object to such a power in Congress. Where there is to be a new branch of representation arising immediately from the people, and which branch alone must originate those very grants that are to maintain an army, when we consider that this branch is to be elected every 2 years, there is a great propriety in its being restrained from making any grants and supporting the army for any longer than that of their existence. If the election of this popular branch, which were for 7 years, as in England, the men would make the first grant, might also be the second, third, and the continuance of the army, and such an acquaintance might exist between the representatives in Congress and the leaders of the army as might be favorable to liberty. But the wisdom of the late convention has avoided this difficulty. The army must expire of itself in 2 years after it shall be raised, unless renewed by representatives who at the time will have just come from the body of the people. It will share the same fate as the temporary law, which dies at the time mentioned in the act itself, unless revived by some future legislature. Now, I want you to understand that the armies that they're really talking about actually is the militia. Because the militia was the standing defense of the homeland. The only time the military is to actually go out, attack, and so forth would be via the Navy and or on land itself. So in other words, You cannot have an army engage in warfare unless it is, you know, because it's on land. You've got the Navy and the Marines, a project force. They go get into ships and they go out and they'll land somewhere. And then just like what they did in Tripoli, that wasn't the army. The army technically was the militia. And if you go back and read Article 1, Section 8, they talk about standing armies. They're basically talking about creating an apparatus of calling upon the militias to become employed as a standing purpose. In other words, if you look at the instance of the militia is actually a state entity, but Congress shall be able to call on them to execute the laws, to suppress rebellion, and to repel invasions. Those three things. So the question is, why would they have a standing army? So they never had a standing army. They had militias, and they were supposed to pay for them. So what ended up happening, and I've said this time and time again, that the standing armies or the government's involvement, the federal government's involvement in militias really went away. The only time we actually engaged in foreign hostilities was really with the Navy and the Marine Corps. I mean, the Army did not get deployed until much later. And as a matter of fact, what ended up happening was instead of using militias, Abraham Lincoln violated the Constitution and actually formed a standing army instead of using the militias. And so we will get back into that, because bottom line, they were supposed to only use the militias, and that's Congress's only power, was to use militias. So we'll be right back after this.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, so getting back to, let me just finish this context on standing armies and the militia. We only had a militia as our natural defense. Now, we never really created an army. The army that Washington used was literally sub-elements of all these different militias, different groups, and so forth. That was the standing army. That's what fought the Revolutionary War. That's what fought throughout Part 2 of the Revolutionary War. they really didn't have this concept of a United States Army as a separate military that would be deployed and sitting in other places. Because, to be clear, that army is not a militia. And that's one of the reasons why when they created that army, Posse Comitatus came along and they said that this army cannot be used against the United States citizens. The U.S. military is forbidden, now I'll use that word, forbidden to be used to wage war against the United States citizens. Only the militia has the responsibility, the authority to be the ones to execute and ensure the enforcement of the law of the land is being followed. So who's the militia? Well, that's you and me. The militia has two segments to it. There is the organized and formed militia with officers and regulars. And then there are the rest of the militia, the unorganized militia, which is the rest of the citizenry. That's why I tell you, you really need to read that article that I wrote. It's on the Constitutional Perspectives page on reclaimingtherepublic.org. Yeah. Anyway, I'm just trying to hurry to get in back into this. And this next comment or this next citation or quote is from John Hancock himself. And basically, they were just assembling in the afternoon on, let me see, what day was this? This was the, this had to have been the 17th, Thursday, February, Thursday, February, January 30th. So, because right there's 31 days. Let me see here. Yeah, it was January 30th. I'm correct. And so it's always about being correct, right? I just want to make sure that you know in context where we are. So if you want to go into the ratification debates, you can actually look these things up. That's why it's important to cite this stuff. So anyway, after they all reassemble, President Hancock makes this comment. He says, a motion has been made and seconded that this convention do assent to ratify the Constitution, which has been under consideration. And that he had, in the former part of the day, intimated his intentions of submitting a proposition to the convention. My motive, says he, arises from the earnest desires to this convention, my fellow citizens, and the public at large, that this convention may adopt such a form of government as may extend its good influence to every part of the United States and advance the prosperity of the whole world. And see, he gets this. The framers understood that as America became the bastion of liberty, that they believed it would be, as Reagan said, a light to the world so that people would want to enjoy and bask in liberty themselves. His situation, His Excellency said, has not permitted him to enter into the debates of this convention. It, however, can you imagine John Hancock just sitting there not being able to engage in the events as the president or the chair of all of this? It, however, appeared to him necessary from what had been advanced in them to adopt the form of government proposed. But observing a diversity of sentiment in the gentlemen, of the convention, he had frequently had conversation with them on the subject, and from this conversation, he was induced to propose them whether the introduction of some general amendments would not be attended to the happiest consequences, for that he should, with the leave of the honorable convention, submit to their consideration a proposition in order to remove the doubts and quiet the apprehensions of the gentleman. And if any degree the object should be acquired, he should feel himself perfectly satisfied. He should therefore submit them, for he was, he said, unable to go more largely into the subject if his abilities would permit him. Rely on the candor of the convention to bear him witness that his wishes for a good constitution was sincere. And then this is what he read. This gentleman concluded His Excellency's propositions, and then he submitted these propositions. And it then goes to John Adams. And then John Adams basically, you know, thanks the honorable president, his excellency, then that those, basically those are the kind of words that they use. And then Mr. Adams says this, as your excellency was pleased yesterday to offer the consideration of this convention, certain propositions intended to accompany the ratification of the Constitution before us. Now, I want you to understand here, this was the first time any of these conventions, Delaware, Pennsylvania, the rest of these, they had not considered creating a list of amendments that they thought needed to be implemented. And so he says, I did myself the honor to bring them forward by a regular motion, not only from the respect due to your excellency, but from a clear conviction in my own mind that they would tend to affect the salutary and important purposes which you had in view, the removing the fears and quieting the apprehensions of many of the good people of this commonwealth, and the more effectually guarding against an undue administration of the federal government. So what he's saying here is that these amendments, the Bill of Rights, was to guard the people and the states from an undue administration of the federal government. Most people think that the Second Amendment was guaranteed to the people by all governments. No, the Second Amendment, the First Amendment, these were all restraints placed upon the general government. The state still had the power to, you know, apprehend you and take your guns and do whatever tyranny they wanted. But they knew that if they did that, it would be over for every single one of those politicians, and they'd probably be very similar to the French Revolution. They'd be sent to the gallows or to the to a guillotine or what have you, right? I mean, the French Revolution used guillotines, but anywho. He goes on and says, your excellency's first proposition is, quote, that it be expressly declared that all powers not expressly delegated to Congress are reserved to the several states to be by them exercised. In other words, everything that wasn't constrained and everything that wasn't delegated to the federal government or upon the states, because you got to remember, Article 1, Section 9, Section 10, I believe, is the restrictions that are placed upon the states, where the states can't do this, the states can't do this, like they can't pass bills of attainder and ex post facto laws, they can't go into contracts, you know, creating compacts among themselves and so forth. So anyway, he goes on and says this, this appears to my mind, and this is John Adams speaking, not John Adams, Samuel Adams, my bad. This appears to my mind to be a summary of a Bill of Rights which gentlemen are anxious to obtain. It removes a doubt which many have entertained respecting the matter and gives assurance that if any law made by the federal government shall extend beyond the power granted by the proposed Constitution and inconsistent with the Constitution of this state, it will be an error and adjudged by the courts of law to be void. So in other words, when they pass a law that says you can't say bad things about politicians or you can't speak bad about the government, then they would recognize that that would be a, you know, that would violate the First Amendment because they cannot pass any laws, and the court would basically void that and say that's not a law, it's stricken, you know, it's gone. It is consonant with the second article in the present Confederation that which retains its sovereignty, freedom, or that each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right which is not by this Confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. I have long considered the watchfulness of the people over the conduct of their rulers the strongest guard against the encroachments of power, and I hope the people of this country will always be thus watchful. This right here basically speaks to the importance of patriots watching and guarding against encroachments of power. Now, when you have legislatures, and I'm just going to say this as an example, because in Washington state, they are going after a state legislature, a legislator who has been standing up actively, went down to the Hammonds in Oregon, went down to the Bundys in Nevada and in Idaho. There was a veteran that they were going to take the guns from him. And this is a state legislature who has stood up and said, federal government, you have no authority to do this. And has been involved in the resistance in trying to point out and guard against these encroachments. That's what we're supposed to do. He says, I have long considered the watchfulness of the people over the conduct of their rulers. That's the people. And our legislatures, those who are our public servants, have even a greater obligation to stand up against this type of tyranny by the federal government. So when we come back, we'll finish Samuel Adams' quotes out of the ratification debates. And this, too, is on February 1st, 1788. And we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so continuing on with Samuel Adams addressing the different amendments that John Hancock had suggested. Another of your excellency's propositions is calculated to quiet the apprehensions of gentlemen, lest Congress should exercise an unreasonable control over the state legislatures with regard to the time, place, and manner of holding elections, which by the fourth section of the first article are to be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, subject to the control of Congress. I have had my fears lest this control should infringe on the freedom of elections, which ought ever to be held sacred. Gentlemen, who have objected to this controlling power in Congress, have expressed their wishes that it be restricted to such states as may neglect or refuse the power vested in them, and to be exercised by them if they please. Your Excellency proposes in substance the same restriction which I should think cannot be met with their full approbation. The power to be given to Congress to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises has alarmed the minds of some gentlemen. They tell you, sir, that the exercise of the power of laying and collecting direct taxes, here's the word right there, direct taxes, might greatly distress the several states and render them incapable of raising monies for the payment of their own respective state debts or for any purpose. And as a matter of fact, if you want to understand something, the fact is that drives the cost of goods and everything else up, because bottom line, it is taxes. And so when government starts doing more and more, what they have to do is they have to inflate the currency and make you think, well, I'm making all this money, and slowly but surely your disposable income and your ability to do things gets harder and harder and harder because the government is taking more and more from you. Anyway, going on, he says, they say that the impost and excise may be adequate to the public emergencies in the time of peace, and ask why the laying direct taxes may not be confined to the time of war. Very interesting proposal. You are pleased to propose to us that it be recommended that, quote, Congress do not lay taxes, direct taxes, but when the monies arising from the impost and excise shall be insufficient for the public exigencies, the prospect of approaching war might necessarily create an expense beyond the products of impost and excise. How then would the government have necessary means of providing for the public defense? Must they not have resources to other resources besides impost and excise? The people, while they watch for their own safety, must and will have a just confidence in a legislature of their own election. The approach of war is seldom, well, except for nowadays, because as Eisenhower pointed out, the military-industrial complex realized they make a lot of money when they're invoking war and so forth. Anyway, the approach of war is seldom, if ever without observation, it is generally observed by the people at large, and I believe no legislature of a free country would venture a measure which should directly touch the purses of the people under a mere pretense, or unless they could show to the people's satisfaction that there had been, in fact, a real public exigency to justify it. Your Excellency's next proposition is to introduce the indictment of a grand jury. Now, I want you to understand this. This is the first point that we're getting into that actually talks about grand juries. Okay, so this is where, because the grand jury is a great tool and mechanism for the people to keep control of their government by using the laws of the land and making sure that the supreme law of the land is being complied to. Now, the grand jury, 9 times out of 10, and they talk about it here, is also focused on crimes and such. But if you understand when somebody takes an oath of office and they violate that oath of office, they have just committed perjury, which is a crime. So Your Excellency's next proposition is to introduce the indictment of a grand jury before any person shall be tried for a crime by which he may incur infamous punishment or loss of life. Interesting. And it also follows, and we actually want to point out, if you understand Section 3, if you commit moral perjury as a public servant, you do not go to jail. You do not get killed. You don't serve time. If you are identified as a moral perjurer, you violated your oath of office, the consequence is you're simply removed and you are banned for life from ever serving as a public servant again. And good luck trying to get Congress to actually take away that disability, because that would really piss off people at home if Congress was actually taking away removing the disability of a bad public servant who's a communist, like Oso the communist. She should be removed. because of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, all legislatures in Congress, even at the state level and all the way down, when you take an oath to support the Constitution, that doesn't mean that you can't obey the Constitution. A great example is the whole thing with immigration. I'm going on a tangent here, but the point is that Congress has a responsibility to stop this invasion on our southern border. Article 4, Section 4 clearly states this, that they guarantee that they will keep and protect us from an invasion. And also the communists and everybody else who has voted to continue to have open borders and allow the invasion to continue, they are violating their oath of the Constitution in supporting it. And he goes on and says, and it is followed by another which recommends a trial by jury in civil actions between citizens of different states. Now, the interesting thing is that the grand jury was not introduced by the federal government, that the federal government would be able to do this. But the states do have the power, and states, all the states have the power under common law to be able to form county, in the counties, grand juries to actually do what I was just saying, to go after people who are committing crimes, even moral perjury and violating their oath. Anyway, he says, these and several others which I have mentioned are so evidently beneficial as to no need comment of mine. And they are all in every particular of so great nature and so equally interesting to every state that I cannot hut persuade, and that's what he says, H-U-T, cannot hut persuade myself to think they would all readily join with us in the measure proposed by Your Excellency, if we should now adopt it. Gentlemen may make additional propositions. That always kills me when they say gentlemen, and it's more of an attention. The gentleman may make additional propositions if they think fit. It is presumed that we shall exercise candor towards each other, and that whilst on the one hand, gentlemen will cheerfully agree to any proposition intended to promote a general union, which may not be inconsistent with their own mature judgment, others will avoid making such as may be needless or tend to embarrass the minds of the people of this Commonwealth or our sister states, and thereby not only frustrate Your Excellency's wise intentions, but endanger the loss of that degree of reputation which I flatter myself this Commonwealth has justly sustained. Interesting. So he basically, you know, kind of laying it out there that he thinks that this is just awesome that we have these bills of rights that they want to induce or add to the Constitution. Here's the interesting thing. At this point in time, they wanted to amend the Constitution. Some of these things, they just wanted to make changes, but most all of these things were additions or restrictions that they wanted to place upon the general government. The question is, there was nowhere, actually not the question, it's a point of fact or a point of order, that there was nowhere in the Constitution of how that mechanism of amending the Constitution was to be done. Thus, during the Bill of Rights debates, because we got less than a minute, we have a few more citations we'll get into in our next episode regarding Massachusetts. But the consequences of not having that mechanism defined of how amendments were to be handled and inserted became a huge debate. And I truly believe Madison was correct. I believe that if there was an amendment that was actually changing a part of the language of the Constitution, that the Constitution's language changed so that you didn't have to read, like the 12th Amendment, you didn't have to read Article 2, Section 1 regarding the choosing of the president, and then go to the 12th Amendment to figure out what the differences were. What should have been done was they should have actually submitted the absolute change in the language itself of the Constitution and then changed the Constitution. That would have been the best way to do it, so the people could then see the old and then the new and then understand what the differences are, instead of actually looking at the as stated and the as changed, and then you have to figure that out. But anyway, We're out of time. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. Actually, no, we've got one more. I'm sorry. We have one more segment, so we'll be right back and get into more guns.
Folks, Red State Talk Radio has brought back its monthly newsletter. I know everyone gets a lot of emails, but this is not a daily or weekly newsletter. It's a monthly newsletter. So you will not be overwhelmed with a plethora of emails from Red State Talk Radio. Come on, it's only once a month. I'll be contributing a constitutional perspective to one of the current issues to help everyone see an alternative perspective, or what I believe would be a framer's perspective regarding the issue to help us maintain a constitutional paradigm. I will also provide information regarding a significant historical context to the time of year so that we can remember our history, so we will not be doomed to repeat the inevitable failings from forgetting our past and origins. Just go to Red State Talk Radio and sign up for the newsletter. This way you can get a focused view of what is going on in the Republic as well as what is going on at Red State Talk Radio. Thank you.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, sorry about the mix-up. Yeah, with this last segment, we're going to be covering a few more citations. This one was from Mr. Nason, and this one is really more focused on the concept of standing armies. And I want you to understand, when they're talking about standing armies again, they're really talking about the militia. And most people don't understand, and to me, I think they completely miss the brilliance of the militia. Because had they created a standing army, then they could actually bring people from different parts of the country to go into your state to force some types of taxes that they may have laid upon one state. Now, here's the interesting thing. The brilliance of the Constitution is that there has to be a uniform application of all taxes. So in other words, there would never be the necessity of parts of the Union being able to go into one state, because all states would be hit with the exact same types of taxes, such as taxes on whiskey and or, alcoholic beverages and so forth. And so when they talk about standing armies, they're talking about the militia, because, and they don't get into it here, but they definitely get into it in the Virginia debates, where they understand that it's the militia that is supposed to enforce the laws. So in understanding this, these men are very apprehensive of the fact that they're going to have a militia. I think that they did not understand that having the militia was going to keep the federal government from being able to create an army that they had full control over. You got to understand that you're better off having your own countrymen, your own neighbors, people from your community as parts of the militia to enforcing the constitutional laws. When you start bringing people in from different areas, they don't know you, they don't know your community, and they don't care. Their job is to take, to extract their pound of flesh. The militia, it's a part-time gig. It is not something that they actually fund standing on. Now, they're supposed to fund the militia, and that's what the Constitution says. if you read, I believe it's Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 16, they are supposed to pay for the arming and the equipping and the training of the militia, but they can only call them forth for the execution. In other words, they're not supposed to call the militia up full time. They're not supposed to do that. And so that was one of the reasons why they said, okay, but if you have to, if there is a civil unrest or what have you, and insurrections and rebellions, and you have to, you can only do it at 2 years at a time. They understood that when government has the power to enforce their own laws, then they will continue to pass laws to oppress you. So anyway, this is what Mr. Nason says. The eighth section, Mr. President, provides that Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, etc., excises and etc. We may, sir, be poor. We may not be able to pay these taxes and etc. We must have a little meal and a little meat, whereon to live and save a little for a rainy day. But what follows? Let us see. To raise and support armies. Here, sir, comes the key to unlock this cabinet. Here is the means by which you will be made to pay taxes. But will ye, my countrymen, submit to this? Suffer me, sir, to say a few words on the fatal effects of standing armies, that the bane of republic government, a standing army. Was it not with this that Caesar passed the Rubicon and laid prostrate the liberties of his country? By this have 7/8 of once free nations of the globe have been brought into bondage. I want you to understand this. With the federal government creating their own enforcement agencies, the BLM, FBI, and all these other, DOJ and the rest, they're creating a standing army because they are a perpetual enforcement, and it is a violation of the Constitution because only the militia can do this. We never amended the Constitution for the federal government to actually have their own execution and own enforcement. It was to be done by the militia. And so time would fail me were I to attempt to recapitulate the havoc made in the world by standing armies. Britain attempted to enforce her arbitrary measures by a standing army. But, sir, we had patriots who alarmed us our danger and who showed us the serpent and bade us beware of it. Shall I name of them? I fear I shall offend your excellency, but I cannot avoid it. I must. We had a Hancock, an Adams, and a Warren. Our sister states, too, produced a Rudolph, a Washington, a Greene, and a Montgomery who led us on our way. Some of these have given up their lives in defense of the liberties of their country, and my prayer to God is that when this race of illustrious patriots shall have bid adieu to the world from their dust as from the sacred ashes of the phoenix, another race may arise. Who shall take our posterity by the hand and lead them on to trample on the necks of those who shall dare to infringe on their liberties? Sir, I had a voice like Jove. I would proclaim it through the world, and had I an arm like Jove, I would hurl the globe. I would hurl from the globe those villains that would dare attempt to establish in our country a standing army. I wish, sir, that the gentlemen of Boston would bring to their minds the fatal evening of the 5th of March of 1790, when by standing troops they lost 5 of their fellow townsmen. He's talking about the massacre, the Boston Massacre. I will ask them, what price can atone for their lives? What money can make sacrifice those loss? The same causes produce the same effects. An army may be raised of pretense of helping a friend, or many pretenses might be used. Let me just go on a side here. You notice that there's no mention of the sheriff. Just want you to know that. There's no mention of the sheriff having these responsibilities. That night, sir, ought to be sufficient warning against standing armies, except in cases of great emergency. They are too frequently used for no other purpose than dragooning the people into slavery. But I beseech you, my countrymen, for the sake of your posterity, to act like those worthy men who have stood forth in defense of their rights of mankind, and show to the world that you will not submit to tyranny. I just want to say this. That's exactly what Matt Shea and many of the state legislatures who joined the Coalition of Western States and those types of things, that's exactly what they're trying to do. They're trying to be like the John Hancocks, Adamses, and so forth. They are trying to point out that the federal government is exercising powers that they do not have, and they're using a standing army to do this. Now, I'll be honest, these words aren't coming from these people. These people are just saying, you know, to be clear, they're really not articulating this very well. They're not identifying really what the problem is, because nobody gets into the Constitution to this detail. They just know that, hey, this is just wrong. You don't have the power to take property. They're going on these different tangents. And I'm trying to put context to this. The Constitution guarantees that we need to be protected from these things. That's why this is so important, so that these good leaders can become great leaders, because they understand the Constitution better. They put it into context that the federal government cannot create a standing army. They can only call upon the militia. That's why they're not using the militia, because they know the militia would be apprehensive in trying to enforce laws that are not within the Constitution. Anyway, what occasion have we for standing armies? We fear no foe. If one should come upon us, we have a militia, which is our bulwark. Let Lexington witness that we have the means of defense among ourselves. And it's really sad that he's not talking about the militia to enforce the laws. I think they completely missed it in Massachusetts. Anyway, if during the last winter there was not much alacrity, A-L-A-C-R-I-T-Y, alacrity, shown by the militia in turning out, we must consider that they were going to fight their countrymen. Do you, sir, suppose that had a British army invaded us at the time, such supineness would have been discovered? No, sir, to our enemies' dismay and discomfort, they would have felt the contrary. But against deluded, infatuated men, they do not wish to exert their valor or their strength. Therefore, sir, I am utterly opposed to a standing army in a time of peace. And I think that's a very interesting perspective. But if you understand the world has changed, I think the states have to have this conversation. Do we want to have and ensure that we have a level of security? Now, having the army sitting in Germany and having the army sitting in Korea and other places, Korea is probably a very important place to be, because there is actually a DMZ and a threat. During the Cold War, there was a need for having the army in Germany because of the potential of communism if you understand, communism is the world's empires of colonialism, trying to take, and subjugating people. Communism is all about subjugation and slavery. And what we were trying to do, and that's why we had the armies there, is to support and defend liberty. Well, we're going to wrap up the Massachusetts debates in our next episode. I'm G.R. Mobley, and we are now Reclaiming the Republic at the end of this show, and we'll be back. Thank you so much.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.